Rexnord Industries v. Habasit Belting Inc. Mr. Cross, we're ready when you are. And you're reserving 5 minutes of your time for rebuttal, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
May it please the Court, I would like to cut through the hundreds of pages of briefs in this case and try to focus on two errors of law committed by the Board and then focus on its refusal to adopt the examiner's first two grounds for rejection of claims 1 through 23 and claim 25.
Can I ask a very, very specific question? Because I think this is actually not about big themes, but about specifics. Claim 23, before the Board, you miscited a patent you relied on, which I think is supposed to be the 247 patent, but you called it the 246 patent. Did you attach to your brief to the Board the correct patent?
I will have to rely on Mr. Peary to try to find the answer to that question.
This has to do very obviously with the waiver question about your argument about claim 23 as disclosing why a skilled artisan would put the hole closer to the bottom surface.
Understood. We also think we can get that claim canceled based on the argument that I'm going to address now, I hope.
Right, but that claim is not covered by the kind of the global obviousness argument that covers 1 through 22.
Yes, there is an anticipation argument based on that.
I said the global argument that covers the obviousness for 1 through 22. I know you have about 17 arguments that cover different groups, but 23 is not part of that particular one.
Understood.
We submitted a supplemental response with the correct number and the correct patent.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, we submitted a supplemental response with the correct number and the correct patent.
Thank you.
Thank you. The first error committed by the Board, and it is probably the most significant error, is that the Board did not give the claims their broadest reasonable construction. The other error is the Board did not apply a KSR obviousness analysis. I'll start with the claim construction error because, as with many cases, this case turns on claim construction. And the claim construction in this case comes down to the Board's narrow construction of one word that appears in all of the independent claims, and that word is across. And if there is one thing that we ask Your Honors to do, it is to look very carefully at the Board's construction of the word across.
Is that the portion of, you're talking about a web portion extending across the intermediate width?
That's exactly right. We quote that at page 16 of our principal brief, followed by the court's, what we believe, erroneous construction. And the part of the construction that we want to focus on is the last phrase, the corrugated portion ending at the opposite upper or lower surface of the intermediate section for the entire intermediate width. That word entire is a big red flag. It is not in the claims. It is nowhere in the specification. So where did the word entire come from? Well, Habasit has supplied the answer for that question at page 32 of its principal brief. Entire comes from the word across, which does appear in all of the claim language. Habasit cites Webster's dictionary for a definition, which it says is from one side to the other. Habasit's dictionary definition is at appendix A995 of the joint appendix. It's Webster's. And if we look at it, it's down in the lower right-hand corner, and it is the second definition from one side to the other. But is that really the broadest reasonable construction here? And that is the problem. There is another construction that is broader and reasonable, and it happens to be the very first definition under this very same dictionary. and it is across. So as to cross, crosswise, crosswise, as in lay the coats across the bed, athwart, transverse, crosswise. None of those words necessarily require entirely across. They all mean transverse, as in I swam across the current. This meaning is broad enough to cover all of the preferred embodiments in the specification, and in fact, it is more consistent with the specification than the narrow construction that was adopted by the board and that Habesit advocates. And we explain that in connection with Figure 2 on page 19 of our principal brief.
Can I ask you which of your arguments for invalidating the surviving claims depends on this claim construction argument you're making now?
All of them, with the exception
depends
of claim
on.
24.
So if I were to disagree with your view that the board got the claim construction wrong, I should therefore reject your challenge, and in particular your obviousness challenge to 1 through 22?
Based on Inch, in combination with Horton, in view of Irwin.
I just want to be clear, because
yes.
I don't think you want to say this.
Let me
state it this way.
Yes.
I am inclined to disagree with your argument about broadest reasonable construction. Should you sit down, or do you still have an argument?
We do have alternative arguments. It's just that I think this one is so obviously wrong and is subject to de novo review that it is the clearest path to get claims 1 through 23 and 25 canceled, as two examiners did below. They applied the broadest reasonable construction, not this narrow one. And the narrow construction adopted by the board wouldn't even cover all of the preferred embodiments in the patent. Take a look at page 19 of our principal brief, where we annotate figure 2 from the specification. Figure 2 shows that because the intermediate width comprises the width of the corrugated portion and the web portion, and the web portion being narrower than the corrugated portion, that the corrugated portion does not extend across the entire intermediate width. So the construction we propose would cover that preferred embodiment. The narrow construction adopted by the board would not. Now, importantly, because this is an issue that needs to be reviewed de novo by the board, you don't have to give any, by this court, you don't have to give any discretion or deference to the construction that the board adopted. And we have summarized the construction that was adopted by the examiners at page 25 of our brief, and you can see its application in the examiner's answer at appendix 538 and 539. The board's narrow construction of a cross is what gave rise to its decision not to accept the first two grounds of cancellation. But once we have the broadest reasonable construction, the Inch's references significance for anticipation and obviousness becomes apparent. Figure 2 of the Inch patent, which we reproduced at page 32 of our principal brief, shows the web in yellow. It doesn't go all the way across the intermediate width, but if properly construed with the broadest reasonable construction, it does not have to. And also shows the corrugated portion in white. And then on page 34 and 35 of our principal brief, we show how the yellow web portion is formed into the white corrugated portion, both laterally and downward through the thickness of these plastic injection molded modules. Now, as the board acknowledged at appendix page 22, it refused to adopt the examiner's obviousness rejection based on Inch because the board's narrow construction led it to conclude there were these deficiencies in Edge because they were looking for a web that went entirely across the intermediate width. But when we use the broadest reasonable construction, as at least two examiners did before it got to the board, the obviousness analysis flows easily from Edge. There is, in fact, no dispute that all of the elements of claims 1 through 23 and 25 are in either Horton or Inch. So what we have here is the same fact pattern that was in KSR. We have a mechanical device that is simply combining known elements to achieve predictable results.
When we review the board's broadest reasonable construction, or put it the other way, when the board's broadest reasonable construction comes up here on review, do we try to figure out, is it correctly the broadest reasonable construction so that we, in effect, adopt whatever we conclude is the broadest reasonable construction? Or do we come up with our traditional right construction, the single right construction?
You do not come up with the single Phillips-type true construction. The broadest,
we
you
don't.
Do not.
Why
you do
not?
Because we're talking about a range of constructions. All, if they are within the range of reasonableness, you are to adopt the broadest one.
Why?
And the policy reason for that is because in reexamination, art presented during reexamination can be subject to amendments, and this is addressed in the court's Morris decision, the policy reason for this. The broadest reasonable construction in reexamination is there because the applicant who has a statutory obligation to price precisely point out the scope of its invention can, if it wants to, amend the claims.
In Morris, we said that our role is to determine whether the board's construction is reasonable, right?
No. And, Your Honor, for that, I would cite you to the Flow Healthcare case, 697 F3rd, 1367. In particular, Judge Newman's concurrence, where she explains precisely there is no deference to be given to the board's construction. None.
In which case, we come up with our own single correct construction.
Your own single correct broadest construction, not the Phillips-type construction that we would be dealing with in an infringement action. That is critically important. As long as the construction is within the range of reasonableness, and we believe across has a reasonable, broader definition, it's right there in Webster's dictionary.
I do actually, I guess, have a question. I'm not sure that this matters, but if the underlying policy behind the broadest reasonable interpretation approach used in a variety of PTO proceedings is that the patentee has the opportunity to amend, why is that policy not rendered inapplicable when the board, establishing as part of this, this is an inter-parties re-exam, this is inter-parties re-exam, says the broadest reasonable interpretation is X. Whether it's right or wrong about that, that becomes something that the world can rely on, and therefore you don't have to worry about amendments to narrow it, because it's, in fact, already been circumscribed as no broader than this. So what would be the point of saying, oh, no, no, it's actually even broader than that, because the world can rely on this being the outer limit?
Because when it comes to the board, there's no opportunity to amend. At the board level, and that's the board reversed the examiner's broadest reasonable construction. So when it, and that That is when they should have been doing their amending.
So there's a final decision of the board that says we are upholding, rejecting, making a variety of decisions about various claims and various grounds for rejection, and doing so in reliance on the patent reaching no further than this. After that has happened, the world can rely on the patent not being, and there's no need to amend to bring it down to that. It's down to that.
I'm afraid I may not be understanding your question. I can tell you certainly that because of the importance of de novo review of the board's claim construction, it is not final. Whatever the construction is, you must, and you have said this on various occasions, we review claim construction anew and without deference. That's the digital biometrics case, 149.
But we don't review it to see what the broadest reasonable construction is. We review anew to determine what the correct construction is.
No,
why wouldn't we do that in this case?
That is absolutely incorrect understanding of the law, Your Honor. I respectfully say that is the case.
Have you read the cases following Morris?
Yes.
They all ignore Morris. Morris upheld the board's standard of review, but the cases following Morris flop around. This is an area of some interest to me, counsel, which is why I happen to be familiar with it. And they flop around, and most of them say, we review the claim construction de novo. We never do anything de novo, but they say de novo, meaning without deference.
Right.
Without deference means we really don't care what the board said. What we care about is what's the right construction. We have never issued a case that I'm aware of that said our review of anything is the broadest reasonable construction. Can you cite a case in which we've said that?
In reexamination, that is the test. That is the test. And Mr. Peary may find me a case that says that, but it, and we'll deal with it if I have any time left for rebuttal.
Okay.
But
you don't have any time left for rebuttal.
Okay.
I'm going to give you some time.
Okay. Thank you.
So maybe you can come up and answer that question.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time. Okay. We'll restore 3 minutes of rebuttal time.
Thank you very much.
Which doesn't necessarily mean we wouldn't agree with you that you're right and they're wrong. The only question is, what is the relationship between the broadest? You make a big case of the broadest reasonable construction.
Yes.
I'm not sure your interpretation is any broader, but it could be shorter.
It could be broader. I understand your point is, are you on review trying to get a Phillips-type true construction as opposed to what is the broadest construction that can be applied within the bounds of reasonableness consistent with the claims. And we'll find a case.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Bailey, you're dividing your time up 13 minutes, and what's it, 2 minutes for your
question? 2 minutes rebuttal. Yes, okay. Sir. Thank you. And may it please the Court, Matthew Bailey here on behalf of Havasit Belting. We are the appellee cross appellant. And I'd like to start with this question that we ended on with Mr. Cross on Phillips construction versus broadest reasonable. And I know this issue was not briefed in our in this case, but I do have some opinions on that. And I do suggest there are three reasons why this court is not bound to follow in its de novo review of the claim construction, the broadest reasonable construction. And I apologize for not having case sites handy here, but the first is judicial economy. Imagine the scenario where we have a broadest reasonable construction in effect established by this court, and then a district court, which there is a pending district court case, comes up under the Phillips analysis. Wouldn't it make a lot more sense to get the true meaning of these claims resolved right here, where we have all the parties here, everything is here, let's establish that here. That's one reason, judicial economy. Otherwise, we'd be back up here.
Well, look, we now have it. Okay. And have had for a while a two-track system with different standards, and there are problems of the sort you just described. But,
yes.
But
that's one reason. The other is, of course, the Federal Circuit has jurisdiction over the district court. And the third important reason is that the amendment time here, for all intents and purposes, is over. unless there's some unusual procedure here, possibly a remand back, Havasut has had its chance. It got new grounds of rejections, and it made an amendment to several claims. So really, the concern that validates the broadest reasonable construction is over. We are now here to, in my view, find the true meaning of these claims and to establish their validity.
Which could go either way. We could agree with the examiner, or we could agree with the board. Whichever way we think is the right way to interpret it.
Absolutely, and I have some view on the board's correct claim construction here. And there are, essentially, to address Mr. Cross's point about the meaning of a cross, there's another important point about the claims themselves that support the board's construction of a cross being having the corrugated portion go over the entire width. And if you take the claim itself and read it, of course the word cross is present, and that, according to our definition, goes from one side to the other. But turning specifically to the language, take claim one, for example, it says the core, I'm looking in the patent on A72, column 6, line 36, it says the corrugated portion extending across the intermediate width between the first and second walls to the other of the upper and lower surfaces, and then it says wherein the corrugated portion has a sinusoidal shape comprising a series of regularly spaced ridges and valleys extending substantially across the lateral width. So the idea that the corrugated portion goes between the first and second walls. Between is another keyword. I submit that the language itself supports the entire concept, the going across the entire width, because it says across, which means from one side to the other, and between, from one wall to the other. And just to pose a hypothetical, if the court were to adopt Rexnard's construction of having it extend only across a portion, then that begs the question, what would be the width of the intermediate section?
Well, I assume the construction they argue for is one, and the reason they call it broader, although physically it's not necessarily broader, is their construction would allow it to extend partially or the entire width, either. Is that your understanding? That's what I take they mean by a broader...
I understand that inference, but I think that would run afoul of the definiteness requirements of claim drafting. So is it partial or is it all the way across? I think if you look at the claim language, Havasut did a very disciplined job trying to define the precise meets and bounds of these claims. If you look in the claim, the word define occurs. We're defining one wall, and then to have a construction in the face of that effort that says, well, it's anything in the middle, just doesn't make sense. It's not supported by the claim language itself. So I can see your point, but I would suggest that the claim language and the preferred embodiments, the figures exactly do show what the board has shown. The corrugated portion does go across the entire.
When Mr. Cross gets back up, I'll ask him for a clarification of his view on that.
Okay.
Can I ask you something that we didn't really talk about in the opening argument, and it may well be that the other side has in fact waived any contention, particularly with respect to obviousness based on Horton and Enchin Irwin. Was that rejections 3? It's a little hard for me to keep track of the numbers of the rejections, but the one that covers 1 through 22, obviousness, Horton, Enchin Irwin, it may well be that they waived any argument for that independent of their broader construction. In fact, their heading says under the proper construction, blah, 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 and they don't make an argument. Put that aside for a minute, and I want to ask you, under the construction that we have, why was the board right about not finding obviousness as to 1 through 22 based on those three sources?
Exactly. I'm glad you asked that question. First of all, I will disagree with Mr. Cross. There has been no concession that all the elements are met in both Horton and Ench. If you look at the board decision, you will see that the board clearly says that it's assumed, almost assumed, that Horton does not disclose a web. It just discloses the corrugated portion. And then on the other hand, there has been some loose language in the briefing, frankly, where the support rib 90 of Ench has been called a web. It's not a web. I'm here to tell you why. The support rib 90, and if you look at column 7 of the Ench reference, is in a bullet shape. And figure 3, I believe, shows this as well. It is not a web. It is a bullet-shaped structure that has three important aspects to it. The first is the bullet shape has a narrower head, and I'm using my hands to gesture here, a wider base and sort of curved edges towards a narrower top. The bullet shape has the idea of minimizing surface contact with the items riding on top of the conveyor belt. I would suggest common sense suggests that support rib is small. The second aspect is with regard to reduction of turbulence, and this is all in the Ench patent. As you wash items on there or fluid flows over, the bullet shape allows the turbulence to be reduced, which is an advantage. Again, common sense dictates that means a small support rib 90. And the third point is that, let me check my notes here. It eases cleaning, which I guess is somewhat associated with reduction of turbulence. But as you're wanting to clean either the belt or the items on there, the bullet shape eases cleaning. And I think common sense dictates that means there's extra space around. So what we have here is a support rib 90 an inch, and we have a corrugated portion in Horton. And the proposed combination takes the support rib and tries to put the bullet shape on top of the corrugated portion, like this. And the question is, first of all, is it a web? I submit, no, it's not. It's a support rib. Second of all, would one of ordinary skill combine these two under the proper KSR analysis? The briefs make much that the board missed KSR. Fundamentally disagree with that. The board got KSR. KSR came out in 2007. It was cited to the board. Of course, the case, the enterprise re-exam started before the examiner, before KSR came out, but 2007 KSR comes out. The board's informed of it. The board writes about KSR in its opinion, cites the right phrase, talking about, and I'll just quote from the board's decision. It says, rejections on obviousness grounds cannot be sustained by mere conclusory statements. Instead, there must be some articulated reasoning with some rational underpinning to support the legal conclusion of obviousness. That's right in the board decision. The board didn't miss KSR. So the question here, when we look at Ench in combination with Horton, or the support rib on top of it, you wonder, why would one of ordinary skill do it? And Rexard makes much as you need to be stronger. Well, we've just explained that the support rib of Ench is intending to be small. And then there's so many questions about how you would put this together, and there's just been no articulated rationale. There's been no reason put forward, and the board found that. Now, this is in addition to what the board found. The board found that the support rib essentially forms the same function as the corrugated portion, so you wouldn't think to add them together. That was my interpretation of the board's rationale. What I've described about Ench, the three functions, is in support of that theory, but it's also in addition to what the board said. So I submit that is why Horton and Ench together, first of all, they cannot be combined, and they certainly do not disclose the rib function. Now, the last combination here is Irwin. Irwin is a reference that sometimes is argued to be part of the combination, sometimes it's not. Irwin simply teaches the addition of a flat bar on top of a radius belt. And just the whole idea of the claim construction, you know, having a web that forms into, that's the claim says forms into a corrugated portion, that is clearly not taught by the idea of just putting a support rib on top. And that's arguably what Irwin teaches, a simple support rib for added strength, and putting that on top of the Horton would not meet the claimed limitation. And then also, just one last point on you know the idea of KSR doesn't require express motivation in the references. So we're allowed to use common sense. We're allowed to speculate a little bit and use what one of Ernest Gill would know. And I'll just make the point that this technology is very, very it's much more detailed than some of the other references, the Dutch manual or the machining manual. These are highly engineered pieces of plastic that are mobile, they move, they have interleaving pieces, and to make the bold assumption that stronger is always better simply is not true. Sometimes lighter is better. Sometimes you need more space. It depends on the application, which is another reason why we submit that these three references aren't combinable on their own.
Mr. Phillips. Bailey. I'm sorry, Mr. Bailey.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot going on in this case. Let me be sure I have the big picture. And if I understand it and count correctly, the board's final outcome of the 25 claims was to allow 14 and reject 11. Is that roughly correct?
Let me check your count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. And if you check that, I think that's right, Your Honor. That's what my notes reflect.
They rejected all of the independent claims but allowed you a number of the dependent claims.
Yes, that's right.
14 is not rejected, which is independent.
Claim 14?
Correct.
Total of 14 claims survived.
Yeah, a total of 14 claims, yes.
That's my
14
counting.
Is green on my
I wanted to be sure I got my count right and I understood which claims were which. Thank you.
And I would like to follow up on the dependent claims and particularly to emphasize three independent claims. 3, 9, and 16. And we think these are particularly supportable in this case, and there's really no clear argument for invalidity. Claims 3, 6, and 19 relate to the link ends of the invention. They talk about where the head is wider than the leg.
So you want them all allowed, and he wants them all rejected. Is that correct?
We did file a cross appeal trying to get the broader claims allowed. I could speak to that briefly if you'd like, but I'm focusing right now on the dependent claims three. Yes, please.
Keeping what you got.
Yes, absolutely. We're here as the appellee. We did not do it initially. We cross appealed in that regard to preserve the broader arguments. Okay. So claims three, they have
You're at the end of your time on 13 minutes.
Okay. I would like to reserve two for rebuttal.
Okay.
Thank you.
Your Honor, as counsel noted, neither party was arguing that you do anything other than review de novo the broadest reasonable construction and not the true meaning in and that is discussed in the DeGeorge case, 768 Federal Reporter 2nd, 1318 in footnote 2, where it says that claims during prosecution, reissue, and reexamination are also given the broadest reasonable interpretation possible, consistent with the specification. That approach does not apply, however, during litigation, where the specification file history should be resorted to in ascertaining the claim's true meaning. Now, your point, Your Honor, is that is a pre-Morris case. And we seem to have walked into an interesting intellectual and important for the parties debate between you and others on the court that is set forth in the Flow Healthcare case and the concurring opinions.
Now, I understand your focus on finding an error on the part of the board by not giving the broadest reasonable interpretation, which assumes that your interpretation is, quote, broader than theirs.
Yeah.
One could play with that, too. But ultimately, I take it, what you really want us to do is uphold your version of the claim, whether we do it by saying that's the broadest reasonable or whether we do it by saying that's the correct interpretation.
That's the true, correct.
You really don't care, do you?
I disagree with your view of the law. I really do believe...
I haven't stated my view of the law
okay.
yet.
If
you go back, you will find I wrote Morris.
You did?
I did.
Sorry, Your Honor.
Now, that gives you pause, doesn't it?
It is interesting. It is fascinating. But I do believe that it certainly makes sense. If the board is to apply the broadest reasonable construction on review, that is the test you should be looking for when you look at construction de novo. You're right. For the purpose of this case, whether you find that our proposed construction is the true one, the one that was adopted by two examiners and then two additional examiners vouched for it. So four examiners thought that this was the broadest reasonable construction. It's not necessarily ours. But whether you adopt that one or the Phillips type and rule in our favor, we thank you. As far as the obviousness construction issues go, it's really significant to point out that the Ench reference, which is a very significant reference, as you can see, was withheld from the Patent Office by Havasit during the initial pre-issuance prosecution. But when the examiners saw it during the reexamination, they, two different examiners, one in 2005 and one in 2006, both said, combining Ansch and Horton in view of Irwin that explains the motivation is obvious. Significantly, those two examiners were operating in a pre-KSR world. It's pretty clear to me that if Ansch had been before the Patent Office in initial prosecution, this is one of those applications that would never have issued, certainly not in a post-KSR world. And the error.
Do you want to give us a concluding statement?
I will.
Sentence?
Yes. And the error that the board committed was by not applying the broadest reasonable construction. It didn't find the elements in Ansch, and then it went about looking for an express motivation to combine Ansch and Horton, and that is pre-KSR mentality. Okay. Thank you very much.
Two quick comments. First of all, Havisett advocates that the claim construction adopted by the board is the broadest reasonable construction, and submits this court should adopt that. And second of all, Mr. Cross commented that there was a withholding of a reference Ansch during original prosecution. I'm not aware of that, and I don't think that to be true, but I am concerned that there's some suggestion of inequitable conduct during the beginning of purposeful conduct withholding Ansch. To my knowledge, that's not in the record.
Can I ask one question?
Sure.
This brings up this perhaps tiny aspect of the case, but Claim 23, the board didn't really discuss, or tell me if I've just missed it, the relevance of the 247 patent, which I take it was in fact submitted in some supplemental filing, the 247 as part of the analysis of the transverse openings.
Mm-hmm.
Is that a flaw in the board's analysis that needs to be, requires reconsideration?
One moment, Your Honor. Yeah, Randy, do we confirm that the supplemental was...
Oh,
yeah. Your Honor, to be quick about this, I can't confirm whether a supplemental amendment was filed, although I take counsel's word that it was. Is the Claim 23 something that should be struck? I think there are other grounds in the record to support what Habs is seeking in this case. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That concludes our arguments for today.
All right. The Honorable Court is adjourned until tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock a.m.